You're listening to KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 in Berkeley, and KFCF 88.1 in Fresno.
And now it's time for the morning news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with news headlines. Oakland Mayor Jean Kwan says her city will not host the Urban Shield International Police Training Exercises and Weapons Expo next year. Hundreds protested Urban Shield this weekend. The exercises came just weeks after a heavily militarized police force confronted protesters in Ferguson, Missouri, where a police officer killed an unarmed African-American teenager. Linda Corey filed this report from downtown Oakland.
Inside the conference room, vendors showcased their latest in law enforcement equipment, from armored vehicles to high-powered assault rifles to SWAT team footwear. International participants from Singapore, Brazil, and South Korea were in attendance this year. Sergeant J.D. Nelson of the Alameda County Sheriff's Department, who hosted the event.
It is a shame that it has come to this. It's a shame that we have to wear a bulletproof vest to go to work. But I don't think that there's anybody that would suggest that we should not wear a bulletproof vest to go to work. And by the way, that's military technology.
You used to have an officer that would help you get your cat out of the tree or to walk you home if you were lost. But now they patrol our streets as if they are in a war zone. This is our community. This is not the war.
That was the voice of Geraldine Bluford, mother of Alan Bluford, who was shot and killed by Officer Miguel Masso of the Oakland Police Department on May 6, 2012. Dan Siegel, civil rights lawyer and candidate for mayor of Oakland, told me that Oakland spends $10 million a year on police misconduct.
I have been concerned for years about Urban Shield because it's a manifestation of the war on drugs. And as part of that war on drugs, again, since 1980, the United States Defense Department has been providing local police departments with all sorts of military equipment. Armored personnel carriers, planes, helicopters, automatic weapons.
While Urban Shield is officially a disaster preparedness exercise, it is funded by the Urban Area Security Initiative, a Department of Homeland Security program that mandates 25% of its funding be allocated to counterterrorism activities. This is Linda Khoury with Pacifica Radio, KPFA in Oakland.
President Obama confirmed this weekend he will delay taking executive action to halt the deportation of undocumented immigrants, despite a pledge he had made to act by the end of the summer. Obama said the surge of unaccompanied immigrant children entering the country changed the politics surrounding the issue.
And in terms of these unaccompanied children, we've actually systematically worked through the problem so that the surge in June dropped in July, dropped further in August. It's now below what it was last year. But that's not the impression on people's minds. And what I want to do is, when I take executive action, I want to make sure that it's sustainable.
The decision to delay drew immediate condemnation from immigrants' rights groups. The director of United We Dream said the decision was another slap to the face of the Latino and immigrant community. The director of Presente.org called Obama's announcement shameful and said Obama once again demonstrated that for him, politics come before the lives of Latino and immigrant families. The decision reportedly was made to help vulnerable Democratic Senate incumbents Mark Pryor of Arkansas, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, and Kay Hagan of North Carolina. House Republican Speaker John Boehner sent in a statement that Obama's decision to delay rather than abandon the idea of executive action on immigration smacks of raw politics. Boehner himself said the idea of immigration reform was dead in the House after the defeat in a June Republican primary of Republican Majority Leader Eric Cantor. He was beat by a candidate who had criticized Cantor for advocating a deal on immigration reform. President Obama plans to deliver a major speech Wednesday, laying out plans to go on the offensive against the Islamic State group, which has captured large swaths of Iraq and Syria. Obama will meet congressional leaders tomorrow to seek their support. Obama already has authorized U.S. airstrikes in Iraq against the Islamic State. In the latest strikes, U.S. warplanes attacked Islamic State fighters thought to be threatening Iraq's Haditha Dam. A video released last week of U.S. freelance journalist Stephen Sotloff being beheaded by the militants led to fresh calls from lawmakers in both parties for a more aggressive approach. A federal appeals court in San Francisco today will consider challenges to same-sex marriage bans in Nevada, Idaho, and Hawaii. It will be the first time the court revisits the issue of same-sex marriage since striking down California's ban, Proposition 8, in 2012. The U.S. Supreme Court ultimately let that decision stand last year. Since then, state and federal court judges have overturned bans in more than a dozen states. The numerous same-sex marriage rulings in recent months have raised the pressure on the U.S. Supreme Court to decide the issue. Last week, 15 states that allow same-sex marriage and 17 that don't asked the high court to weigh in. The European Security Watchdog says the ceasefire struck between Ukrainian forces and pro-Russian separatists was largely holding today in eastern Ukraine despite sporadic violations. The ceasefire is part of a peace plan intended to end a five-month conflict, the United Nations Human Rights Envoy said, has killed more than 3,000 people. It has also caused the sharpest confrontation between Russia and the West since the Cold War. A Ukrainian Defense Council member, Volodymyr Polyovy, said the ceasefire was still in force. His remarks were translated by Al Jazeera Television.
The firing and shelling is a violation of ceasefire conditions. The situation is under control now. Over the last 24 hours, we didn't have any information about civilian casualties. And at the moment, we're not talking about a cancellation of the ceasefire agreement.
Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko visited the eastern Ukrainian port city of Mariupol today and vowed to defend it from pro-Russian separatists who advanced toward it last week before the ceasefire agreement. The two sides remain far apart on the future of eastern Ukraine. Over the weekend, rebels repeated they want independence for the region or a union with Russia and will not accept rule by the central Ukrainian government. Former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger returns for a rare visit to the state capitol today for two public events. He'll take part in a high-profile discussion of California's fight against climate change. Then he'll help unveil his official portrait at the capitol. Today's climate change forum takes place ahead of United Nations conferences on the issue in Lima, Peru, Paris, and at the UN in New York. Governor Jerry Brown also will attend today's symposium. Discussions will highlight the costs of failing to move away from fossil fuels, citing noticeable changes such as the expansion of California's wildfire season and the state's devastating drought. A wildfire burning for weeks in the backcountry of Yosemite National Park grew unexpectedly yesterday. The blaze forced the helicopter evacuation of about 100 park visitors. Those evacuated included hikers who had climbed Half Dome Peak. Others had to be airlifted from campgrounds and hiking trails in the area. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area. Morning clouds becoming sunny with highs in the 60s to upper 70s around the bay. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, mostly cloudy. A 20% chance of morning showers. Highs 91 to 96 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandary. I'll have more news at 7:30. Continuing our back-to-school coverage on Upfront, we're going to follow up on a story that dominated the media at the start of the summer, the spike in unaccompanied minors crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. Their number jumped nearly 60% in the last fiscal year. This year, officials expect they'll double again to as many as 74,000. The children are mostly Central American, fleeing violence and severe economic problems in the countries they're leaving. Many may qualify for refugee status. but their sheer numbers have swamped the resources the federal government has for housing children while it sorts out their status. The influx drew attacks from Republicans who accused President Obama of encouraging increased immigration. The buses of children moving to and from government shelters even drew angry protests. But here in California, at least, a new field poll shows only a third of voters want the kids deported immediately. 58% of California voters say the U.S. should offer them assistance while it, quote, determines their long-term status. This morning, we're going to take a look at what that actually looks like. What happens to those unaccompanied children when they get here? If authorities are able to connect them with family members, they can wind up pretty much anywhere in the U.S., including San Francisco. Our own Linda Horry reports.
2 years ago, when he was 14, Mario's parents decided to move him out of Honduras. Gangs there can recruit men his age. It took him 1.5 months to get to San Francisco.
In Mexico, it's much harder. There are many thieves that will rob you. You can even wind up sleeping in the streets. When you get to the American border, you have to walk more. You have to be strong because you're going to walk through the desert.
That walk can take 3 to 4 days, longer if you get lost.
Well, it was hard because I was sick. I had gotten very sick, and I could hardly, I was dizzy, fainting. If my brother hadn't been with me, I don't think I would be here today.
When immigration authorities picked up Mario on the U.S. side, they moved him to San Francisco, where he has an aunt and uncle. And in San Francisco, he wound up here. At San Francisco International High School, where all the students are English language learners. A converted elementary school with walls covered in colorful street murals, students shuffle between classes, talking in Spanish and Mandarin. When this high school opened in 2009, about 10% of their students had entered the country as unaccompanied minors. Today, it's about 20%.
They're coming to school every day from 8 to 3, and they're working hard to learn English and get a high school diploma and gain all of their credits.
Principal of San Francisco International High School, Julie Kessler.
And for most of them, what that looks like is then leaving school and working from 4 to 10 or from 5 to 1 and going home and getting a few hours sleep. They're working to pay rent. They're working to support little brothers and sisters. The pressures on them to support themselves and oftentimes their families are pretty immense.
Schools like San Francisco International are the primary support system for many of these teenagers. Denise Martel has been the wellness coordinator and social worker for San Francisco International for the last 3 years.
What I've seen so far is that a lot of the students that come in who are unaccompanied have gone through a lot of trauma, and it could vary. Some have sexual trauma, physical trauma. They've endured a lot of hardships coming to this country.
The Wellness Center gives students physical and sexual health services, as well as psychological and legal counseling.
Some of the things I think all our teenagers face is a lot of being enticed by gangs to join, and so a lot of them have that peer pressure that they need to be a part of that, especially since they don't have any family here or families that they can connect with, since many of them have been separated from their families for a very long time. And so a lot of them do get peer pressure to join gangs or just hang out with them.
But the school still manages to see 80% of its students through to graduation. Of those, 70% get into college. Again, Principal Kessler.
Is it harder here? Are our students dealing with infinitely more than the average teenager in terms of their pressures, their traumas, and what we need to support them with as a school? Absolutely. It is harder. However, we work with some of the most motivated and resilient and intelligent students I've ever met in my life. They have navigated countries and borders. They're able to hide the reality of their housing situation from government agencies who might want to take them away from their brother who's 17 and it shouldn't be their guardian, but is. They've managed to navigate systems so much bigger than school. So while they have greater needs than the average teen, they are also the most powerful group of adolescents I've ever known. So is it harder? Yes. Is it in some ways easier to be working with a student population that has such a rich experience? Yes.
As for the students, it seems to be working.
It's like discovering a new world.
everything changes. You change your schedule, your routine, even what you do for fun. Everything changes. But since I've arrived here, in the United States, they've really treated me well.
This is Linda Hoodie with Pacifica Radio, KPFA in San Francisco.
For those unaccompanied minors who don't have family here, governments are grappling with another problem, figuring out where to house them while the feds sort out their immigration status. When this issue first started getting national attention, the federal government was opening emergency housing on military bases. It was drawing fire from all sides. Immigrant advocates said it wasn't a humane way to treat children. Anti-immigrant protesters attacked the administration for not doing enough to turn the kids away, and they went so far as to block busloads of kids in places like Murrieta, California. Locally, we're seeing a very different response. Santa Clara County is studying how to start matching unaccompanied minors with host families, that is, foster homes, so that they don't have to stay in detention facilities. That would involve welcoming kids who aren't here already into their community. We're joined now by Sparky Harlan, who heads the Bill Wilson Center, one of the nonprofits that's leading the push to bring unaccompanied minors into foster homes in the South Bay. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Explain exactly how this program would work.
Well, Bill Wilson Center's been working with runaway and homeless youth for 40 years here in Santa Clara County, and part of how we work that program is we use foster homes to help house runaway and homeless youth. So the way this program would work is just to expand that model to also include some unaccompanied immigrant youth from the border. We really believe that putting these young people in a mass shelter and often mats on the floor is just really not a humane way of treating these young people. And we know there are a lot of families out there who'd be willing to help out on a temporary basis to house these young people.
But we're not talking about kids who show up in Santa Clara County and need services. You're talking about working with the federal government to bring kids detained at the border up here.
Exactly. Even though we do know from reports that around 150 young people have been placed with sponsors in their family in this community already, that is not the population we're looking at working with. We're actually looking at trying to relieve some of the pressure from the border and taking a small percentage of these kids from those shelters and placing them here in our community in host homes. And we're hoping that other communities actually would take up this effort and this way of treating young people and help take some kids into their community. In the Midwest, there are some programs looking at doing just this thing. We also know that most of these young people, in fact, we've been told 75% or more, actually are coming here and there's a family member they know in this country that they can stay with until they go through the legal process to determine if they can stay here or if they'll be deported. But they do have legal recourse while they're here. But most of them will only be staying with us a short time while we reunite them or with the family member.
So how do you respond to someone who says, look, Santa Clara County should be spending its resources on its citizens, not a bunch of kids who cross the border illegally?
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to take this on is it's actually selfish on our part and Bill Wilson Center's part is we always have a hard time recruiting foster parents. We have a foster home program and we help put kids into these homes, and it's a difficult, especially in this high cost area, it's a difficult job to do that. Our feeling was a lot of people want to help on a short term temporary basis with this population, and our hope was that we'd recruit foster parents who would try out housing these immigrant minors for up to 3 months and then say, gee, maybe I'd like to be a foster parent for the longer term kids. And we've already started recruiting for this program. We've had 25 people who are going through the process now, and we are finding that is the case. We are finding people stepping up saying, look, if we don't have the short-term kids here right now from the border, we would consider being a foster parent for the other kids. So it's really helping us expand our current pool for kids in foster care in this community.
If you go through with it, where would the money come from for administering the placements and for paying the foster families?
Well, that's the thing about this, is the federal government is required legally to pay for these young people in their care until they're placed with a sponsor. So this money would come from the federal government. We actually applied for a grant with Larkin Street in San Francisco in August to look at housing this population in both communities as a collaboration. So San Francisco is looking at providing some housing for kids up there, and we would in Santa Clara County also. But it all would be paid for with federal dollars.
Federal dollars do not move quickly. Would you be able to set this up before you hear back on the grant?
The county has looked here, Santa Clara County, in helping us with some startup funds to basically get the foster home program going. We're taking a gamble, then hopefully we'll get the federal dollars. But if not, then we've talked to the parents already, and a lot of them say they're willing to step up and be our regular foster parents. So either way, we're really going to be bringing in host families to work with runaway and homeless kids, whether they're from our community or from the border. The immigrant kids.
So whatever you wind up doing with the undocumented minors, Santa Clara County, in your view, comes away with a stronger safety net.
It does. And we're also looking at, we can't forget the kids, 150 kids that have been placed with sponsors here, because these kids have been traumatized. And just because they have a name of a relative, they maybe don't really know this relative. And, you know, some of these kids are teenagers and they do come with problems. What if that family suddenly says, I can't handle this kid. They need to go. They need help. Once a kid's placed with a sponsor, the federal dollars are gone. So we could be seeing a population of homeless youth suddenly appear where they're having problems with their sponsors. So we're really looking at what we can do to assure that those kids and new sponsors don't end up having problems and a new homeless population is created.
All right. Sparky Harlan, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Sparky Harlan is CEO of the Bill Wilson Center. That's one of the nonprofits in Santa Clara County, leading a push to bring unaccompanied minors that have been detained by federal officials into foster homes in the South Bay while their status is being resolved. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. Here in the Bay Area, we are at ground zero for the new foodie movement. We have farmers markets year-round, supermarkets that label how many miles away their produce comes from, restaurants whose servers can recite the name of the ranch that that night's cuts of free-range grass-fed meat came from. But our next guest says all of that only begins to scratch the surface of what it means to eat in a way that supports sustainable farming. Chef Dan Barber's new book is The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. Welcome to our studios.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the concept of the third plate.
Yeah.
What's the first one?
The first plate is the American ideal for the last, I don't know, 50 years or so, which is a steak dinner. I mean, it's an 8-ounce portion of steak with a kind of smattering of vegetables and probably overcooked and not very appetizing, and then a little bit of white rice or something on the side. The second plate is you know, where we are in the last, let's say, well, for Berkeley, it's probably more like 20 or 30 years. For the rest of America, it's increasing in the last the last 10 or so. But the second plate is, you know, your steak is grass fed, let's say, and the vegetables are better cooked and they're organic and local, and maybe the grain instead of rice is a whole grain. So the second plate tastes a lot better than the first plate, and more people are eating at the second plate. The problem with the second plate is the architecture looks the same as the first.
So, not dumping as many synthetic fertilizers and pesticides on the ground to produce it,
yeah,
but using the land the same way.
Well, not the same way. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate too much because there's a lot of good in the second plate. There's a lot better than the first plate, let's say. I mean, eating a steak from a grass-fed cow versus a steak from a conventional cow, I mean, there's a lot of advantages to that ecologically, and I would say gastronomically, you're not even close. I mean, you're enjoying a much better plate of food. The problem I have with the second plate, which is the problem I have with the farm-to-table movement, is that we tend to hold it in such high regard, in such sanctimony, that we believe, and I was one of the believers of this, as a flag waver of the farm-to-table movement, that it is the answer to the industrial food system, that it is the way to fight against the industrialization of agriculture, and it's the future of food, when in fact, as I looked at it, I mean, I set out to write a book that was essentially arguing for the second plate and more of it. And what I came to realize was that it's a short-sighted view. It's a very coveted, actually. What we are eating on the second plate are coveted ingredients. It starts with a protein-centric plate of food. It's an expectation. It's an American expectation for dinner, which is an anomaly. It's an agricultural anomaly, which has become this, like, cultural expectation. And unfortunately, we're exporting it to the rest of the world. So the third plate is really to say, can we look at a plate of food, an expectation, not just a plate of food, because the third plate is not one plate, it's a metaphor for a way of eating. Really, it's a cuisine or a pattern of eating. Can we look at a pattern of eating that truly supports a local ecology, what the land can produce? And so by way of example, and I'm serving one now, so it's a good, easy sort of off-the-cuff example, is I have right now on my menu tonight a parsnip steak. Parsnip steak is a plate of food that's centered on a very large parsnip that's been in the ground since last March. It was harvested in late April and early May, and it's been in storage since then, and we're running through it now. But we cook that parsnip like we would cook a steak. We roast it, we bathe it in butter and some garlic and rosemary and thyme, and we slice it as you would slice a steak, and we center it on the plate as you would center a steak, and we serve it with marrow from a grass-fed steak that we raise at the Farmstone Barns, and we serve it with a bordelaise sauce, which is a classic French sauce that is made with beef bones and red wine. It's very rich, very umami flavor. It's fully rich flavor. But the parsnip, because it's been in the ground so long and because it's fully developed in its own flavor, stands up to this very rich sauce. And then on the side, we have creamed spinach, like you would serve with a steak, and creamed onions. And we also serve a marmalade of beef shank. So a marmalade, a beef shank is a cut of meat that we don't eat enough of when we look at the animal. We eat very little of it. In fact, it's a delicious cut full of incredible rich flavors that we make into a marmalade, and we acidify it a little bit like you would a ketchup or a mustard. And that goes to accompany the parsnip steak and round out and give a fullness and a richness to the plate. So that, you know, that turns kind of the T-bone on its head a little bit, and it's like it's a steak for the future. Because it's delicious. We're not talking about giving up on great flavor and satisfaction and delight and hedonism. In fact, we're talking about being greedy for it.
But you're not giving up on meat.
And you're not giving up on meat, exactly.
But it's becoming the condiment instead of the center.
Yeah, which is not, I think that's, you're right to point that out. And I should be front and center. You're not giving up on meat. You're still eating a lot of meat in that plate of food. You're just not eating it in the expectation that we assume is our right and our expectation for what constitutes a meal. And this is where the culture needs to change.
So you basically describe it as a historical anomaly based on,
yeah,
the abundance here.
Yeah, yeah.
The people kind of craft a diet, and then the agricultural system adjusts to provide for it.
Yeah.
Whereas the world's richer culinary traditions grew out of figuring out how to use what people could grow.
Yeah. I wish I had you when I was writing the book, because you've just you've just summarized, I think, very elegantly what I took 400 pages to essentially say, and I think that whittles it down exactly, is that the great cuisines of the world were in constant negotiation with the land. I mean, peasant farming is where we get great cuisines of the world. French cuisine is peasant French cuisine. Initially, Italian cuisine is Italian peasants. And those cuisines were essentially peasants who were eking out what the land could provide, figuring out how do you get agriculture to work, and then taking what the land provided and making it nutritious and delicious and making it last through the winter in many cases. This is the story of the great cuisines of the world, the hundreds of cuisines of southern China, the cuisines of India, and as I mentioned, what we consider to be the great cuisines, the European cuisines. And America, we were never forced into that negotiation. We just dropped the plow, we moved west, we plowed up the prairie. And when that didn't work in the 30s, we kept going. And why I think the third place is important now is because I think we're at an agriculture moment, really a crossroads, is we have no other land to plow up. Although, now that I said that, I will also say that in the last 10 years, we've plowed up 1 million acres of prairie, 1 million acres of virgin prairie that's never been done since the great plow up of the 30s. We plowed up 1 million acres because we were planting corn and soy. Corn and soy have been the whipping boy. Corn especially has been the most maligned vegetable, most maligned grain. It's the emblem of what's wrong with our food system from the farm to table perspective. And yet, with a social movement that's gone viral, that's become the most exciting social movement, and the epicenter, I agree with you, is pretty much right here in Berkeley. Even with that, we have in the last 10 years plowed up 1 million acres of virgin prairie land, and we are at a point where over 50% of our agriculture is in corn and soy. Over 50%. That's just happened in the last 10 years. So big agriculture is not exactly a scared of the farm-to-table movement if you look at the on-the-ground reality. And what I feel is necessary is what you just said, is to figure out a new negotiation with agriculture and create a new expectation for dinner.
We're speaking with Dan Barber. He's executive chef of the Blue Hill and the Blue Hill Restaurant at Stone Farms in New York. His new book is The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. We'll continue our conversation when we return after this news.
I'm Eileen Alfandari with news headlines. The U.S. Senate may take a test vote today on a constitutional amendment aimed at overturning the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United case, which opened the floodgates to spending by corporations and the very wealthy in political campaigns. New Mexico Democratic Senator Tom Utol introduced the so-called Democracy for All amendment. It has the support of 51 senators. Supporters of the amendment are targeting 5 Democrats they say still are undecided: Mark Pryor of Arkansas, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, Joe Donnelly of Indiana, Tim Kaine, and Mark Warner. For the first time since it declared California's same-sex marriage ban unconstitutional, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals will hear arguments over the case. A panel is set to hear arguments on marriage bans in Idaho, Nevada, and Hawaii. The Ninth Circuit in 2012 invalidated California's Proposition 8. The U.S. Supreme Court dismissed the case last year without ruling on the legal merits of same-sex marriage. The court is expected to accept a same-sex marriage case for its term starting in October. Oakland Mayor Jean Kwan says her city will not host the Urban Shield International Police Training Exercises and Weapons Expo next year. Hundreds protested Urban Shield this year. One of those protesting over the weekend was Geraldyn Bluford, whose son Alan was killed by Oakland police.
I don't have my Alan, but I do have a voice today.
Yes.
I have no problem. My son was not perfect, but his life had a purpose. And I'm here today to say, train the officers for the community so that it can change for the better, not continue for the worse.
The Urban Shield exercises came just weeks after heavily militarized police confronted protesters in Ferguson, Missouri, where a white police officer killed an unarmed African-American teenager, Michael Brown. Weather forecast for the Bay Area: morning clouds becoming sunny, highs in the 60s to upper 70s in Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, 20% chance of morning showers, highs 91 to 96. I'm Eileen Alfandari. More news at 8 o'clock.
7:34 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert, spending most of the hour this morning speaking with Dan Barber. He is a co-owner and executive chef of Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, two pioneering restaurants in New York State, exploring the nexus between how we make our food and what we wind up eating. He's just out with a new book called The Third Flate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. Back to the interview. You spend a lot of time in the book profiling grain farmers, sustainable grain farmers, and that seems almost impossible to me. I think of grain as the quintessential industrial crop.
Yeah.
Uniform,
well, it is.
Wheat rows stretching out to the horizon.
Yeah.
Agriculture that requires big chemical inputs and high degrees of mechanization to be economical. What does sustainable grain farming look like?
Yeah, well, we got to figure it out because when I started to look at this, you know, I was the champion of the vegetables in the same way the farm to table movement is a champion of local small-scale vegetable farming, when in fact you look at the agriculture land in this country, it represents about 6% of our land. About 70% of our land is in grain agriculture. The rest is like horticulture. But it's really grains that we're talking about. If we really want to change the food system, there's nothing, again, I have nothing against eating vegetables. I eat a lot of vegetables too. But if we are going to hang our hat on changing the food system with vegetables, we're not going to get very far because the agriculture that controls how we eat in this country is in grain. And you're quite right. When I associate grain to farming, I think of big monocultures because that's generally how they're grown. I've met a few farmers, and one in particular becomes sort of the hero of this book, Klaus Martens. And he is an organic farmer. He makes a ton of money on growing corn. He grows a lot of it. He has 2,000 acres in upstate New York. But he grows a ton of other crops. And I got to him because I was researching. I started to write the book because I had his wheat and this emmer wheat, and it made the most incredible bread I'd ever tasted at that point. And you know, it was the kind of bread I started serving to the diners. Everyone was talking about it. They wanted to sell their first born for another slice of this thing. It was really like a jaw-droppingly delicious. And I went to the farm to see what's the recipe for growing the wheat. And I'm standing in the middle of the field. I'm looking around. I didn't see any wheat. What I saw were all the crops that we were just talking about earlier, the millet and the buckwheat and the barley and the leguminous crops like the cowpeas and the cover crops like the clover. And all of these were timed and planted in a very meticulous rotation because Klaus, was trying to get the fertility that would allow that wheat to taste as good as I experienced it in my restaurant. Well, that seemed crazy to me. Here I was waving the farm to table flag. Here I was taking center stage as the epitome of the farm to table movement, claiming that this is the answer for the future. And I wasn't eating his farm. I wasn't supporting his farm. I was cherry picking as if I went to the supermarket and decided to pluck out one ingredient and call myself the savior for the food system. It made no sense. And it wasn't until I stood in the millet field and realized that I changed really my philosophy of cooking and ultimately what became the third plate, because I realized you needed to cook with the buckwheats and the barleys, and you needed to include a lot of leguminous crops, as every great cuisine. We think of Italian cuisine as mozzarella and tomatoes. In fact, Italian cuisine is beans. And I know why now, because beans are this magic crop. You know, they are leguminous. They trap nitrogen freely from the air. They fix it into the roots, and they supply the soil with much needed. They're like, sort of like a deposit in a bank account, a very large deposit, for which you cannot get wheat unless you have a leguminous crop before you plant it. And same with rice, same with corn. So beans are huge, but it's really the diversity of crops, because it depends on where you're farming. It's the diversity. And I wasn't cooking with the diversity. And that's the problem with the farm-to-table movement. It allows you to go to the farmer's market, like I probably will this weekend, and buy asparagus and peas on the East Coast, and this later this summer I'll buy tomatoes, and I'll feel very good about the transactions. And like that second plate that we were just talking about, it is a good transaction. There's nothing wrong with it. You're supporting the right kind of transaction, and you're doing it directly, and you're approving an agricultural landscape that's local to you. But if that's all you're doing, you are essentially grabbing soil fertility of the most coveted cream crop and calling yourself the answer to the food system, and it's not. What we need to do is look at nose-to-tail. We talk about nose-to-tail eating of animals. We need to look at the nose-to-tail of the farm, and that's cooking with the whole farm. And those are the decisions that farmers are making that are essentially sunk costs. When I looked out in that 2,000 acres and saw that the dozens of crops that were being grown, all of those crops, all of them went to feed animals. They were essentially became bag feed.
There wasn't a market.
Who's eating millet?
Uh-huh.
Nobody. So they go. So we realize their potential as grains through eating meat. Well, that's very inefficient, and that's not anything. That's not a food system. That's actually what it is. It's an American invention. I mean, that just doesn't exist. And unfortunately, like I said, we're exporting that to the world.
And you also find you can't really take the animals out of the food system either.
Yeah, I'm not a vegetarian.
I mean, kind of the Diet for a Small Planet generation told us that because vegetables and grains are a more efficient use of the land than industrial meat production, we should just have no meat in our diets at all if we want to be ecological.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that might work for certain parts of the country. Get a little south from here, get in New Mexico, I don't know, Southern California. If you're a vegetarian and you want to propose that that's the answer for eating for the future, God bless you. I'm with you. If you're in the Hudson Valley, where I am, and you're a vegetarian, I don't see that argument as making any kind of sense for the future of good agriculture because the Hudson Valley was built, the landscape was built on pasturing dairy cattle. That's why we got the beautiful, iconic views of the Hudson Valley. And it was that way for a reason, because we have wet agriculture there and because we have blasted grass and a diversity of grass that converts the sun's energy into fat for an animal and gives us milk and gives us incredible grass-fed beef. The idea that we would be ignoring that because we think it's less efficient than eating another kind of diet is crazy. And that's the ultimate lesson, I think, of my research on 10 years of this book, is that we cannot have a diet, an American diet. There's a real good reason that we don't have a cuisine. In part, we had such soil fertility, we're never forced in the negotiation that cuisine arrives out of. So that's in part of it. The other part of it is we're this like vast country. We're not just a vast country in terms of acreage. We're a vast country in terms of ecological differences. And every couple of hundred miles, we have huge variances in the environment and the ecological realities. And that means that we need to actually have not just several cuisines, several patterns of eating to reflect the landscape. We need to have hundreds. What we're talking about is micro ecologies for which our daily diet should be supporting. That's what all the great cuisines of the world are all about. It's why they're truly sustainable, is because we're still calling them cuisines. You know, they've lasted for thousands of years. That's the true definition of sustainability.
What accounts for the difference between Klaus Martens's wheat and other wheat I might pick up in the supermarket? Isn't wheat just wheat?
Yeah. Well, oof, I was with you, man, until I started looking into this. Wheat is not just wheat. Just to answer your question very directly, there's two differences between this hero of my book, Klaus Martens' wheat, and other people's wheats. And number one is the variety. So what's grown in Kansas, what becomes our wheat? Essentially, there's two varieties of wheat for which we grow on 60 million acres. That's essentially the fact. What Klaus grows on his small farm in his rotations, remember, he's not just growing 2,000 acres of wheat. He's growing very little wheat amongst a diversity of different crops. But the wheat he's growing are always different varieties, Spelt, Emmer, Bavarian Spelt. I mean, he's got, dozens of different varieties. It's that diversity of those varieties that give you variances in flavor and actually remind you that wheat is a plant and that it has incredible notes of flavor that are very distinguishable and very important for both nutrition and also gastronomic potential. The second thing, besides the diversity of the different kinds of wheat, is the soil. And to me, that's why I'm looking at the book sitting here, is why soil became the cover of the book, because all roads led back to soil. In the case of wheat, who knew that how you feed the soil determines how good the flavor of the wheat is? I wouldn't have known that at all. I mean, I guess it's axiomatic to say that great-tasting wheat came from good soil. One could say that and not be laughed at. But to truly understand the nuts and bolts of farming and what that takes, what does it take to get good soil for wheat? Whoa, mama, it is a big, big negotiation. It's a very complex rotation. And as Klaus taught me, there's a real language to soil. Its soil will tell you what it needs if you're ready to listen to it. And he taught me this language, so I have beginnings of a language anyway for me that I totally respected. So the answer to your question is variety and its soil. And those are two things that when you grow wheat in monoculture, you generally ignore both those things, which is why we have the wheat we have today.
Now, the political defense of that industrial agriculture system has been it makes a lot of food and it makes a lot of food cheap for a hungry world.
Yeah, and a growing world.
I have no doubt that everything you serve is exquisitely delicious, but I looked up your menu. They're $40 entrees.
Yeah.
You're not serving the masses that way.
Yeah. Well, I'm serving, you know, those $40 entrees in a particular locale, in a particular ecology, which
Greenwich
is New York
Village.
City. Yeah, Greenwich, and then on a Rockefeller estate for which we are supporting an educational and agricultural entity. Yeah, that's very expensive to upkeep where it is. It's 20 miles from upstate New York. Anyway, I'm not apologizing for what we charge. We charge what we charge because we are in that kind of fine dining realm. But I would be careful when you hear the argument that you can't feed the world with the kind of ideas that are proposed in this book. I don't really attack this head on, in part because I feel ultimately frustrated by the question of feeding the world, because we already, as we all know, produce enough calories to feed 12 billion people. So this idea that we can't feed the world from a agricultural point of view, even today, even with all the problems that we have with agriculture, is really crazy. Every economist, even the conservative one, tell you with plenty of food, it's the distribution system that's terribly unfair and strikingly unfair and demonstratively unfair, and that's what really needs to change. But just to answer your question, to delve into it just for even for a second, and it's not worth unfortunately, it's a very, very important question and a profound one, so I don't mean to give it short shift, but I will say that just in the example I gave you, standing in the middle of that field, Klaus's field, I'm looking around trying to see the wheat, and what did I see? I saw dozens of other soil building, uncovered crops that I wasn't supporting. The problem with your question and the reason that it gets asked in the way that it does is because it sort of forces you into a kind of answer. I mean, now look, if we were to take Klaus's farm in 2008 and compare it to an Iowa farm that produces corn and soy, and you were to say, okay, well, Klaus, how many, what kind of tonnage do you produce of corn versus a typical Iowa farmer on 2,000 acres? Well, now, the Iowa 2,000-acre farm is producing a hell of a lot more corn and soy, that's for sure. And that's the barometer. The problem is that we're not comparing apples to apples because in terms of tonnage, in terms of caloric possibilities, Klaus is producing a lot of food. We're just not eating it. We are essentially wasting it through eating meat, or we are not creating a market for that. If we were to look at the whole system and we were to eat the whole farm, which is really what the third plate is calling for, we can produce a lot more healthy calories and a lot more delicious experiences.
He operates at a small scale. It's a labor-intensive operation.
Yeah.
He is obviously someone who's really, really smart, highly skilled, and very experienced.
Yeah.
Type of farming he developed over the course of a lifetime. Is that something you can scale up?
Yeah. Well, that's the big question. I'll just give you the answer that I feel I found in the book, which is that Klaus represents a class of farming called mid-sized farmers. Mid-sized farmers represent about 40% of the farming that's still going on in this country. 40%. It's an enormous number of farmers, and it's an enormous number of acres of farmland. The interesting thing about mid-sized farms is that they are the ones that we don't champion here in Berkeley and in my restaurant. I champion the small family farmer that can pack up its pickup truck and deliver it to the farmer's market. The problem with a farmer like Klaus and these mid-sized farmers that they're too big for that. They're too big to pack up a pickup truck. They can't do that. But they're too small to compete in the Walmartification of the food system, and they're getting squeezed. The problem I have with it, and the urgency of it, is they are the answer to our broken food system. Because if you are a 20,000-acre corn-soy rotation or a 25,000-acre wheat farm, you are not going to diversify. It's impossible. The entire system is built around you producing just that. If you are a mid-sized farmer, generally speaking, you have a nimbleness, not just of mind, but of distribution, possible distribution systems, to diversify your crops and to create that kind of soil. And we don't have to be a genius. Like, I believe that Klaus is truly a genius, but you don't have to be. Many farmers are actually doing what Klaus is doing, not to the extent that he's doing it, but many farmers are doing the kind of rotation that Klaus doing to bring the fertility to their soil. They're just not getting paid for it. And they make their money on just a few crops. That's not a problem with the farming. That's a problem with what we're eating, which is why I call it the third plate in the end, because I see as the change agent here is what we expect for dinner. And that's where we can change the mid-sized farmer. The mid-sized farmer is the one who can feed school systems. It's not going to be a small farmer. That's crazy. They can feed hospitals. They can feed all the institutions for which we're really talking about changing the food system. And by the way, that includes manufacturing processed foods, too. We shouldn't leave that out. That's a part of the American reality, as it will always be. But what we need are the nimbleness of farmers who can produce something other than those mighty grain crops, the rice, the corn, and the wheat. And you can't do it when you're an industrial scale. It's the mid-scale, mid-sized farmers that have all the potential. And unfortunately, we're squeezing them out.
We're speaking with Dan Barber. He's executive chef of Blue Hill in Manhattan, out with a new manifesto for the future of sustainable, delicious eating called The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. You profile some of the other traditions that have grown up around this type of farming and eating in the world. Describe the dehesa in science. Yeah.
The dehesa is a 2,000-acre, essentially man-made savanna. And you talk about what is inherently a terribly hard landscape. Actually, Extremadura is the region that dehesa is in. Extremadura can be translated as extra hard landscape. It's brutal. And what farmers ended up doing in their negotiation with the land is creating these oak trees that are spaced out between each other. And they drop these incredible acorns, and pigs, for the most part pigs, go from tree to tree eating these acorns when they drop in the fall. And they eat the grasses along the way. And it produces this incredible pork, this incredible jamon ibérico hams, for which is probably the most expensive culinary product in the world. What I learned from going and spending some time in the dehesa is that while we celebrate jamon ibérico for a very good reason, we ignore, by the way, the Spaniards don't ignore, but we, as an understanding of the dehesa, we concentrate on the jamon ibérico. What we don't concentrate on is the hundreds of other products this land produces. I mean, grains, real diversity of grains and vegetables and foraged items in the forest, with huge mushroom for which they forage huge amounts of mushrooms and leguminous crops. And it's an entire agriculture system. It's been around for about 2,000 years. It is led with the pigs, because that's the money maker and the one that they're most famous for. But the entire cuisine, Extremaduran cuisine, is based on supporting the Tejasan landscape, which now is very rich and fruitful. And what I got into it because I tasted a natural foie gras, something that I was told could never be possible to produce a fatty goose liver without gavage, without force feeding. Well, in fact, it is possible. Someone's been doing it since 1812. Eduardo Souza's family, the great-grandfather, was doing it. I met Eduardo Souza because I went to research this recipe. And what I realized is that the geese, the fatty goose livers that I tasted, were really piggybacking off of an agriculture system that was rich, truly rich in diversity and truly rich in culinary potential, for which the Spaniards use it to its full potential. And we Americans concentrate on the jamon ibérico without seeing the whole system. And so I fell in love with the dehesa because I fell in love with the diversity. I fell in love with here is an area of great disturbance. Here is where farmers over generations have disturbed the land, but they disturbed it in a way that's sympathetic to the natural workings of the ecology, and they've brought on animals, a huge variety of animals, not just pigs, but sheep and grass-fed beef cattle, and they make cheeses and all the rest, and they've enabled a richness to develop out of what is essentially a desperate landscape.
So the ethical foie gras, explain how this works. We've actually had policy debates here in California about whether or not foie gras should be outlawed, because, as you said, our understanding is it always involves force-feeding geese to fatten up their livers.
Yeah, and it does, except here it is. It doesn't have to.
How do you get it by?
I went to learn it. And what I learned is that the geese are piggybacking off of the richness of an entire system. And so Eduardo Souza, to your earlier point, is not producing a lot of foie gras. He's not in any way identifiable as an industrial producer. He's a real artisan. But the livers that he's able to fatten off of the system are incredibly delicious, and they're essentially free because the richness of the agriculture system that's been coddled and supported over 2,000 years enables the geese to feel, in the words of Eduardo, this is not me, it sounds very kumbaya, but this is Eduardo, feel like they are being cared for. And according to his philosophy, if you allow a goose to feel like it's being coddled and cared for, ultimately it will reward you, or in his words, God is rewarding you by saying, thank you for treating the geese so well, we are going to reward you with a beautiful fattened liver. Okay, so it sounds a little weird. But you look at the system up close and you kind of see what he's talking about. It is a system that produces a ton of bounty, and the geese feast off of it, and we get this beautiful product. The problem with foie gras, and I don't wade into the debates of whether it should be outlawed or not. I have no idea, really. The problem I have with the debate isn't the debate itself. It's that we're having the debate about the wrong thing. We're concentrating on the discomfort of the animal, for which I am not qualified to give you an opinion on whether or not it's inhumane or not, and I have my doubts about it, actually. What I feel is wrong about the debate is that we are not talking about the amount of grain that it takes to feed a duck or goose liver, which is a totally unsustainable and actually gross amount of grain. And talk about feeding the world. I mean, this is the ugly part of raising a goose liver. What Eduardo does is really take off of the natural abundance of the land and give you a foie gras liver, which, by the way, he does not prepare as Americans prepare it. Americans prepare liver as slicing off a slab like we would a steak, searing it in a pan, and giving it to you as a small foie gras steak. Well, that's ludicrous. No one ever ate that way. Nobody ate that way in the world until very recently. Well, how did they eat foie gras? They ate it by eating pâté. And pâté is a wonderful way to experience a lot of products, but especially a goose or duck liver, because it stretches the liver. So one liver is enough to feed, 50 people over the course of several days. And in the case of good pâté, it'll last several months. This is a very sustainable way to eat. It's gluttonous to a certain extent. It's expensive. There's no question. Eduardo's liver are $700 a liver. But when you amortize that cost over the number of people that you can feed off the liver, because you don't need a lot to eat this, and you shouldn't need a lot, you're eating a tiny bit of it, it is a totally, I argue, and I think there's a way to back this up, that it is both seriously sustainable, delicious, and also the answer, a little bit of a parable to how we should be thinking about our food system in the future.
And so I guess the key here is that he's only selling as much as his landscape can sustainably produce.
And he's done.
Not as much as the market has demand
for. Yeah, and he has a ton of demand for his. Yeah, exactly. Now, I forget that. I don't even know I said that in the book, but that's exactly right. He stops. He says, I asked him, I don't know if this made this book, but how do you know how much to produce? He said, the geese tell me. When they fatten up and there's enough of them, I bring them to market and I'm done for the year. That's it. He probably raises 1,000 a year. The interesting thing is now with climate change hitting the Dehesa, in some ways it's been good for the Dehesa for some products, but for the geese it's been a disaster, and he can't. This part of the trick to raising a natural foie gras is that you trick the geese into gorging themselves. And the way you do that is you wait until the fall when the weather starts to turn cold. And weather starts to turn cold, the goose freaks out because it realizes that it's abundance, so the dehesa is going to disappear.
It wants to fatten up.
It wants to fatten up, and it fattens itself. The problem is if it never turns cold enough, if the weather difference between a summer and fall into winter is not extreme enough, that DNA of the goose is not kickstarted, and you get a goose that's a little lazy about its next meal and isn't as ferocious and won't scavenger the kind of calories it needs to fatten the liver. And what he's seeing are smaller livers and geese that are kind of like couch potatoes because they don't need to scavenge for their next meal, because they know it's not going to be that cold and they'll be out there, it's fine. When it turns cold, years ago when I was there and when his grandfather was raising them, it started to turn cold, the geese flipped. And they are like little dinosaurs. These are not little geese that you see. I mean, they're frightening animals. They'll kill coyotes. They're very strong, very ferocious. And they go nuts. And they just start eating everything. And that's when their livers balloon. And that's how he enables the natural foie gras to develop. But interestingly, like, climate change is affecting Eduardo because he can't get his geese to kickstart that natural reaction to the cold weather. And therefore, his livers are really suffering.
All right. Dan Barber, we're going to end on the image of geese kicking coyote ass.
Yeah, that's a better image than the global climate change. It's geese kicking ass.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Dan Barber is the executive chef of Blue Hill in Manhattan. He's out with a new manifesto for the future of sustainable, delicious eating. The book is called The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tieker. That does it for today's show. Up Front is a production of the KPFA News Department. We're here weekday mornings at 7 a.m. If you'd like to give us feedback or suggest something for us to cover, send an email. The address is upfront@kpfa.org. A big thanks to everyone who makes the show happen. Eileen Alfandary is our executive producer and our news editor. Laura Privis is our senior producer. Our production interns are Linda Hoori and Henry Matarossi. Kirsten Thomas is at the controls. My name's Brian Edwards-Tiegert. Coming up next, Uprising with Sonali Kolhatkar. I'll see you tomorrow morning at 7 a.m.
Tune to KPFA, KPFB Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno.
This changes everything is the title of an urgent new book by Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine. Naomi will present This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate, on Monday, September 29, 7:30 p.m. at First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing Way in Berkeley. A KPFA benefit, wheelchair accessible, co-sponsored by Earth Island Journal and Movement Generation. This will be hosted by Jason Mark, editor of Earth Island Journal. Advance tickets at brownpapertickets.com or at supportive independent bookstores. That's Naomi Klein, September 29. This changes everything.